Daniel chapter 4, we begin in verse 1. You'll notice immediately that this chapter is actually narrated by Nebuchadnezzar himself. The only chapter perhaps in all the Bible narrated by a pagan king. And yet I trust that by the end he was no longer a pagan. But in Daniel 4 and verse 1 we read, Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore made I a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. Then came in the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, and I told the dream before them, but they did not make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But at the last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And before him I told the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen, and the interpretation thereof. Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all the flesh was fed of it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and an holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, Hew down the tree, and cut off his branches. Shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it, and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof. For as much as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. The tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven have their habitation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and an holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee, and they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. The same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar. And he was driven from men, and did eat grass as oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? At the same time my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me. And my counselors and my lords sought unto me. And I was established in my kingdom. And excellent majesty was added unto me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. Amen. We'll end our reading at the end of chapter 4, knowing that the Lord will add His blessing to this reading from His Word for His name's sake. If I could call your attention in particular to verse 35, where we have Nebuchadnezzar's confession now, and he says, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? Nebuchadnezzar had learned the lesson at last. By the time you reach chapter 4 in the book of Daniel, it seems hard to resist the conclusion that this king was a very slow learner. I suppose it could be argued as a general principle that pride has a tendency to make slow learners out of any sinners, especially proud sinners. Chapter 4 gives us the account of Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. And the lesson that we draw from his second dream was essentially the same lesson that he should have learned from his first dream, which occurred back in chapter 2. And this was the lesson that he was slow to learn. And in between his first and second dream, he saw firsthand something that should have reinforced the lesson of the first dream, for he saw how the God of heaven could preserve his followers even in the midst of a fiery furnace heated 7 times beyond its normal capacity. Still, he was slow to catch on to the lesson. And the lesson was really very simple. It's a lesson that Christians need to affirm. It's a lesson that, unfortunately, Christians all too often are too slow to acknowledge also. The lesson is simply this: God rules and reigns. God rules and reigns over the kings of the earth. The reduction of Nebuchadnezzar to a beast was to serve the purpose stated in verse 25, "Till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will." Now, arguably, it's better to be a slow learner than to be no learner at all. And eventually, Nebuchadnezzar would confess that the Lord's dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, "What doest thou?" This simple lesson about the sovereignty of God over the kings of the earth is the key theological lesson to the book of Daniel. And unfortunately, many Christians who seem to be more interested in producing their prophecy charts have a tendency to skip over the obvious, or at least they fail to draw the benefit that comes from affirming the glorious truth that God rules in the heavens, and God rules over all. This, to my mind, is the great blessing of the book of Daniel. We see God ruling and reigning. We see God ruling from the heavens. We see God predicting the course of history. And we see God setting up one and bringing down another in accordance with His rule. That's the blessing of the book. I think the same thing holds true for the book of Revelation. "Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy," John writes in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 3. And I believe the blessing gained does not come by being able to tie in news headlines with Bible verses. The blessing comes rather in seeing Christ. The testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy, the angel says to John in Revelation 19 and verse 10. And in that book too, we see Christ ruling over all. We see Christ's kingdom prevailing. We see Christ's followers triumphant over the world that despises them because the world despises Jesus. Now, returning to the book of Daniel, let me just say here that I love the fact that it was a pagan king that was eventually compelled to confess that God rules over all. This was not a ruler that received his education from the rabbis in Jerusalem. It was a ruler that worshipped and served idols. It was a ruler that was steeped in darkness. As slow a learner as he was, and as proud a sinner as he was, his slowness and pride didn't prove to be insurmountable obstacles for God. And we can take heart that God is able to humble the pride of any proud sinner. even proud sinners that are world rulers, and He's able to make any sinner know who truly rules and reigns. I find this lesson to be particularly appealing at this time when we have proven to ourselves as a nation through this last election that we are anything but a Christian nation. In terms of where we find ourselves as a country today, I think you would agree with me that there's a definite sense in which we could say we're in exile. Now, it's true we haven't been supplanted the way Daniel and his people were supplanted, taken out of Jerusalem and brought to Babylon. We haven't been supplanted, but on the other hand, there's little, if anything, around us that resembles our Christian heritage. Prayer has been banned for the longest time from our public schools. Creation or even intelligent design theories are banned from our world of academia. Morality has been turned on its head in such a way that sin is sanctioned and virtue was outlawed, and there's a great deal of apprehension in the air because the immoral and ungodly pagan religion of secular humanism appears to have been greatly strengthened in our civil government as a result of our last election. Add to this apprehension about our political and our moral climate the immediate worry and anxiety that comes from an economy that is clearly headed in a downward direction. What will the outcome be, we ask ourselves? Will I have a job tomorrow? Will I be able to provide for my family next month or next week? Will the outlook and planned policies of our newly elected president only make the situation worse? Amidst such discouragements and worries, it becomes essential for the Christian to be able to affirm by faith the sovereign rule of God over every dominion in the world. I love that part of the vision in the book of Revelation that depicts the horse going forth with the man on it, the angel on it with the scales. Giving the cost of barley and the cost of wheat. I'm distorting it terribly, I know. The whole point being, God's sovereign rule extends to economies as well. And so what I want to draw your attention to this morning in the moments that remain is the benefits to affirming God's sovereignty. The benefits to affirming God's sovereignty. Consider with me, first of all, that one of the benefits to affirming God's sovereignty is that it keeps everything in its right perspective. Affirming God's sovereignty enables you to keep everything in its right perspective. We learn from the example of King Nebuchadnezzar how incredibly short-sighted a pagan ruler can be and how hard it is for pride to die. Look with me, if you would, in chapter 4, verses 28 through 30, where we read, "All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, 'Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?' In his dream 12 months earlier, the point was emphasized to him that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. Look with me, if you would, in verse 17 in chapter 4. This now contains the actual dream as Nebuchadnezzar recounts it. "This matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basest of men." Then go to verse 25, where you have the account now of Daniel's interpretation of the dream. They shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven. And seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. You find that to be a point of emphasis then, don't you? As far as the content of the dream goes, he heard this angel saying this. So far as the interpretation goes, Daniel really had to do little explaining. Basically, all he had to do was to reiterate what the angel had told him. This is going to happen to thee until you know who really rules in the affairs of men. His first dream back in chapter 2 served the same purpose and should have conveyed the same lesson. In chapter 2, you may recall, if you know the book of Daniel, God showed this king how history was going to unfold. In that dream, he saw an image whose head was gold, typifying the Babylonian Empire. The breast and the arms of the image were silver, typifying an inferior empire to follow the Babylonian Empire. The belly and the thighs were brass or bronze, typifying yet a third empire to follow, and the legs were iron with iron feet, the toes of which were mingled with clay, typifying a fourth empire to come. In that dream, Nebuchadnezzar saw a stone cut without hands out of a mountain, which smashed this image on the toes and broke the image into pieces, and then grew into a great mountain, thus teaching a very clear lesson that it will be God's kingdom that triumphs in the end. And how did Nebuchadnezzar respond to that lesson? Well, we find him in chapter 3 making a great image. But rather than following the pattern of the image that he had seen in his dream, which had a gold head, we find him instead making the entire image out of gold, which some Bible teachers feel indicated that he tenaciously held to the view that it would be the Babylonian kingdom, which would be a never-ending dynasty. Hence, not just the head was gold, but the entire image. His pride contributed greatly to his short-sightedness. By the end of chapter 4, however, it seems that he caught on. The last testimony that he bears in the book of Daniel is found at the end of chapter 4, where we read his final words. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. I find it interesting and comforting to observe in the book of Daniel how on two different occasions, involving two different pagan rulers, you find the beginning of a chapter revealing the passing of an ungodly decree, and then you find at the end of those same chapters the issuing of other decrees, perhaps a modifying of the first decree, that calls for respect to be shown unto the God of Daniel. The first instance of this is in chapter 3. Look with me in that chapter again, if you would. Chapter 3, verses 4 through 7. Then an herald cried out, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." There's the king's decree to begin the chapter. Well, you know the story, and we read it this morning. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow to the king's idol. And when, in his grace, they were given a second chance to bow, they still refused. This provoked the king's wrath all the more. The command was given to heat the furnace to make it 7 times hotter. The 3 Hebrew children were cast into the furnace and yet were unaffected by the flames. And not only unaffected by the flames, but the text makes it plain that Christ stood with them in the midst of the fiery furnace, in the midst of those flames. The thing I want you to see is that a decree occurs in the beginning of the chapter, and another decree occurs at the end of the chapter. Look with me in verse 29 of chapter 3. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language would speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their house shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. We find 2 decrees then in the same chapter. One calls for bowing to an idol. The other calls for respect to be shown to the God of Daniel and his 3 friends. I look at a verse like that and I begin to dream a little bit. I say, oh Lord, that thou wouldst make the pagan ruler of our nation issue such a decree that blaspheming the Lord become illegal. Could God do it? Well, we've seen that He has done it. He can indeed do it. We find a second instance of the same phenomenon in chapter 6. At that point in time, we discover in chapter 6, the Babylonian Empire had been conquered by the Medes and Persians, just as God said would happen. Under King Darius, Daniel is set up over all the presidents and counselors. Just like in the realm of politics today, this makes Daniel's associates jealous. Through their shrewdness, they're able to convince King Darius to approve a law, a statute, a decree, if you will, that bans prayers or petitions to any god or man. All prayers and petitions must be directed to the king alone for a 30-day period. Look with me at that, if you would, in chapter 6. Verses 7 through 9. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. And again, you know the story. I should have added verse 9 that indicates to us that King Darius signed the writing and the decree. And again, you know the story. Daniel continues his regular practice of prayer. His associates bring charges against him, and before the chapter is ended, we find Daniel in the lion's den, and we find Daniel's life preserved by God. At the end of the chapter, we discover yet another decree made by the pagan king. Look with me in chapter 6 and verse 25. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He that delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Isn't it interesting then how on 2 distinct occasions you find a chapter that begins with a decree that sanctions idolatry, or a decree that outlaws prayer? And by the end of the chapter, on 2 different occasions, at 2 separate periods of time, with 2 different pagan rulers, you find decrees issued again. One calling for people to be very careful about how they use the name of God. Another calling for people to tremble before the name of Daniel's God. Now the lessons that these two events should convey to the followers of Christ today are plain. The Lord rules and reigns from above and is able to overturn the plans of pagan rulers. Ungodly decrees can be turned into decrees that call for respect for the God of heaven. The other lesson that comes readily to mind is the lesson that the people of God can expect fiery furnaces and dens of lions. The sovereignty of God does not, you see, exempt the followers of Christ from the trials of their faith. There is an aim in the trial of your faith. So Peter writes in his first epistle that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. When we see paganism seemingly strengthened, therefore, and when we see the increase of our trials, either as a result of the ungodly rulers and decrees as a result of providential circumstances, let's keep all of these things in their proper perspective. God rules and reigns, and there is a purpose to your trials. A purpose of grace that will lead to your faith being found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. Interestingly enough, we find a statement made by Nebuchadnezzar that shows us the effect of affirming the truth of God's sovereign rule. Note what we read in chapter 4 and verse 36. At the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my Lord sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Note the beginning in particular. At the same time, my reason returned unto me. Do you see the connection between affirming God's sovereignty and a man's sanity? A follower of Christ who loses the perspective of God's rule and reign is, in a sense, you might argue, reduced to the level of a beast. A beast that lacks sanity. I'm sure many of you are aware of the maddening strain that presses you sore when you think you're on your own and you're tempted to think that with everything else God rules over, He's somehow forgotten you and left you to fend for yourself. Man, that's enough to drive a person to the brink of insanity when he so loses sight of the sovereign rule of God. I don't honestly know how a person could get out of bed in the morning who didn't believe that God rules and reigns over all. So let's affirm in our worship this day the sovereignty of God. The same one who sets up one and brings down another is the same one who rules today. And His rule extends not only over those that occupy high office, but His rule extends over you and over me. Indeed, we're told in the Gospels that a sparrow cannot even fall to the ground apart from your Father in heaven. Such is the sovereign dominion of our God. We gain the benefit of sanity and stability by keeping these things in their right perspective. Would you consider with me next and finally that the benefit to affirming God's sovereignty is also seen, and that it should strengthen our resolve to be faithful. It should strengthen our resolve to be faithful. I brought this up in prayer meeting the other night. Two simple things: the sovereignty of God and the strength of the resolve of Daniel and his friends. While Nebuchadnezzar was a slow learner, I don't believe the same could be said for Daniel or his three friends. There may have been a time when they doubted God's sovereignty and perhaps doubted God's love and loyalty. After all, they were in a land of exile. They were brought into captivity. Jerusalem had been captured and plundered and would be destroyed, and the temple of God had been plundered, and we're told in the opening verses of the book of Daniel that part of the vessels of the house of God had been carried into the land of Shinar and placed in the treasure house of Nebuchadnezzar's false god. Oh, it certainly gave appearance to the carnal eye that God was not on the throne. How could this have happened with God on the throne? They would have wondered, and many would have doubted. Even in the midst of such abysmal circumstances, however, I don't believe Daniel ever doubted. His prayer in chapter 9 contains his confession that the Israelites had sinned and that God had been faithful even to the threatenings of his judgment. And so he prays in Daniel chapter 9, O Lord, to us belongeth confusion of face, to our kings, to our princes, and to our fathers, because we have sinned against thee. To the Lord our God belong mercies and forgiveness, though we have rebelled against him, neither have we obeyed the voice of the Lord our God to walk in his laws, which he set before us by his servants the prophets. And so it appears in chapter 1 that the effect of the adverse circumstances of Jerusalem upon Daniel was not to weaken his faith, but to strengthen it. And so we find him as early as chapter 1 and verse 8 demonstrating his resolve. In fact, look with me at that verse. This is one you should note. It's one you should highlight. It's one you should memorize. Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. This resolution on the part of Daniel is rather amazing, isn't it? Especially when you consider it in its setting. Daniel had been uprooted from his home. He had been carried away into captivity. How easy it would have been for him in the bitterness of his circumstances to say, the Lord has forsaken me along with his people. Why should I bother to serve him? Why shouldn't I just go with this new flow and indulge in the king's meat and the king's wine? Do you ever find yourself tempted to ask yourself the same question when your circumstances have taken a terrible turn for the worse? You have it rough while the ungodly seem to prosper. That was certainly the case in Daniel's day. The ones that enjoyed prosperity and took their ease and indulged in the meat and the wine were the same ones that worshipped idols. The psalmist complains about this very thing in Psalm 73. In fact, I'd have you turn to that psalm with me if you would. Psalm 73. And note with me the first three verses from the psalm. Truly God is good to Israel, even to such as are of a clean heart. But as for me, my feet were almost gone. My steps had well nigh slipped. For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. And in the verses that follow, the psalmist goes on to describe the prosperity of the ungodly at some length. And then the psalmist shares the conclusion that he had arrived at in his weakness in verse 13. He says, verily, I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency. For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning. He's complaining in this psalm that the ungodly have it easy and he had it hard. And why should that be? And why should I serve God if that is indeed the case? That's the natural reaction of the flesh to adverse circumstances. And the psalmist later acknowledges his weakness and his short-sightedness. Thus my heart was grieved and I was pricked in my reins, he says in verse 21. So foolish was I and ignorant I was, and note this because this ties back into Daniel, I was as a beast before thee. You see it again, the failure to realize that God reigns reduces someone to the near lack of sanity, the near insane level of a beast. Daniel, however, saw the whole matter from the right perspective, from the outset. He knew that even in his captivity, the Lord ruled and reigned in heaven, and so his focus became sharpened on his obligation to be faithful to his God, and so we read that he purposed in his heart not to defile himself. Our knowledge of God's rule and reign should have the same effect on us. Our resolve should be strengthened to be true to our God and King. Oh, that we might be delivered from the easy flow of this world, the easy flow of immorality and marital infidelity and a lack of personal responsibility. Why not go that way, the flesh asks. It's the way all the world is going. And obviously, God must not be too concerned, for He's allowed men to come into high office. That will make sin easier. Sin is acceptable and the world understands. So go with the flow and spare yourself the hardship and vanity of serving God. Oh, may God help us to avoid such beastly insanity. I must say that if this recent election has had any positive effect upon me, it would be that it's made me sharpen my focus to the truth that our nation's problems are spiritual before they're political. And spiritual problems must be confronted through the use of spiritual means, which means in turn that we need to be seeking the Lord as never before. And this leads to my next sub-point about Daniel's resolve. He was resolved to seek the Lord in prayer, even when prayer was made illegal. So we read in Daniel 6 and verse 10, Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he's doing this with his eyes open. Do you see that? He knew that the writing was signed. He went into his house, and his windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. He was resolved to seek the Lord still. Now the prayer life of Daniel is worth a study all in itself. Let me just point out here that Daniel would not be denied his time in prayer. He went to prayer knowing the writing was signed, verse 10 tells us. This would indicate to us that he also knew the penalty for violating the signed writing, which was being cast into a den of lions. Daniel wouldn't be denied. I've often marveled at Daniel's resolve, especially as I compare it to the way that we are so easily distracted from the place of prayer. What does it take to keep you from seeking the Lord? Is it a busy schedule? I wonder how busy Daniel was. And you look at the ranks of this man. You look at the fact that he had attained favor with the king, undoubtedly for his competence, to such a degree that he's set up over the presidents and over the counselors. I don't imagine that made his schedule any easier. Yet he wouldn't be denied. Is it a busy schedule that keeps us from prayer? Is it worldly entertainment? It's amazing to me how many people have so little time for prayer, but don't seem to be lacking in time to entertain themselves by means of the world? Is it the weakness of the flesh? How I would that we would draw from Daniel's example and devote ourselves to seeking Christ. I mean, when you stop and think about it, how else will hearts be turned? How else will the ungodly decrees be overturned? How else will the child of God protect himself from caving into anguish and despair? These are days that call for the strengthening of our resolve, not for making excuses for ourselves, no matter how valid those excuses may seem. Now, I shouldn't pass from this point of increased resolve without mentioning those three Hebrew children who also showed their resolve in chapter 3. When the decree was given to bow to the king's idol, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not comply. And when they were arrested and stood before the king, they stated their resolve in no uncertain terms. So we read in verses 17 and 18 of chapter 3, "If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and He will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." Their assertion reveals that they had no certain assurance in the temporal realm that they would be delivered. They did know that they would be delivered from Nebuchadnezzar if it meant death. That's the amazing thing about death, you know. Once you've been put to death, your tormentors have no more power over you. Once you've crossed Jordan, so to speak, you're entirely in God's hands. This is why Christ instructs His followers not to fear them which kill the body but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear Him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Those three Hebrew children recognized something that they viewed as being of much greater importance than their own survival. They viewed the honor of God as being the most important thing, even above their lives. How they stand in contrast to the mindset of our day, which subordinates God Himself to the happiness of the man. Oh, it's my happiness that's the all-important thing. The honor of God must be subordinate to that. No, we have it backwards. It's the honor of God that's the all-important thing. My happiness, or even my life, must be subordinate to that. Those Hebrew children had the right perspective on God. And so I hope you can see the importance of establishing and maintaining the right perspective yourselves. Take heart this morning, believer. God rules and reigns, and His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom that will never be destroyed. He sets up one and brings down another. He rules and overrules the decrees of men. And this ruler over all nations happens to also be your Savior and Lord. He orders all things for your good and His glory. And so long as you can affirm by faith His sovereign rule, you will also be enabled to view every circumstance in life from the right perspective, from the higher perspective of His rule, and from the eternal perspective of His purpose. Your sanity and stability and confidence and peace depends on you being able to make such an affirmation of God's sovereign rule. Your steadfast resolve to be true to Him depends upon you holding an exalted view of Him. And so I hope and trust this morning that you will, with the eye of faith, see him seated on his throne, the one who gained his kingdom by virtue of what he accomplished in his atoning death. May your confidence in him be strong, and as you strive to honor and serve and know him, then may it become your privilege to do great exploits in his name. Let's close then in prayer.